Reconduir. Let's turn this down. That's it. Okay. How's that? Is that reasonable? Okay. Let me know if it's not the right volume. I can theoretically adjust it. It's good? Okay. So when I read the bill... It should have a buzz. How about this? How about let's try with the split? How about that? How about that? Is that too soft? How about that? Is that a reasonable? Okay, so Mark, see where I'm holding it? About here? And they'll yell at you if you don't do it right. Okay, so when I do this, you're supposed to salivate. And the happy thing is that most of you know what I'm talking about, that this is Pavlov's dogs and stuff. Yeah, anyway. Okay, so let's see. The fact that the whole audience knew this. Did I tell you this on an anecdote? I gave a presentation to a group of MIT alumni, older MIT alumni like me, a week and a half ago, and I think I told you this. And I asked them how many people knew about mindfulness, and two, and one of them was a guest. And then I asked how many people knew about the chakra system. Again, two, one is guest, and there's like 55 people. I thought, geez. There's work to be done. Okay, so the books that were... there's one book left. Joe Favreau's book is for borrow also, and two copies of mine, and Abraham's lovely book of poetry and limericks, etc., is also for borrow. So those things will circulate for the next few weeks. Okay. Let's see, Robert, let's do this.
In a moment, sorry,
we lost our friend Michael. I don't know. I don't know whether he's alive or dead, but we lost him. He used to record the things and I would post them. But anyway, if you go to swt.org/Spencer, you'll see this page in the upper left one with our hero there, class talks, audio recordings. If you click there, then you'll see, it's kind of primitive, but you'll see the class recordings in order by when they're recorded. And starting last week, I'm recording them, so you'll see down there at the bottom, 2022, 10:14, and then click on it and you can play the rest. Sorry, yeah, it starts off a little chaotic. All right.
I just want to thank Robert for doing this. Actually, the quality of the talk came out real well last week. You can hear it very clearly. So if you want to hear it again when you weren't here last week, Joe Favreau talked, and it was pretty dense what he said, and I think pretty important. And so you just click on that to hear it. If you want to hear anything from the past or any of the other things on the site, you just go there. So there's a whole bunch of stuff here for you to look at. Videos we've seen in class in the past. It's all thanks to Robert. All right, so let's meditate first, and then we will learn a little bit about whatever Mark has to share with us that I will pull out of him. All right, so you can do whatever you want in these 10 minutes while we meditate, or whatever you want that's legal. Moral and not fattening, but if you're doing mindfulness, one thing I want to emphasize is the opening process. That is, it's not just a question of calming down and noticing what's happening. It's a question of allowing yourself to open at every level. And when you do that, you come from a more contracted view of reality to a more expanded view of reality. And you don't make that happen, you just allow it to happen by inviting relaxation, inviting expansion. If you try to make it happen, you actually contract yourself. So you just create the space for that to happen. And it happens in terms of how you feel about your body lets go of tension. It also happens in terms of how your mind works. It seems as though your mind opens, so there's more space for whatever is happening mentally to come through. It's also how your heart opens, so there's more space for all the feelings to happen. And as you expand, you come to a different view of reality and a different definition of self. At the most contracted view of reality and self is the most pathologic. That's a person that is totally self-preoccupied, doesn't even connect to the rest of the world. If neurotic, is so self-focused that barely connects to the rest of the world. But it's a contraction of the view of what reality is and who you are. So the pathology is on the contraction end. And as you move toward more openness, you go toward healing, and then psychological health, and then spiritual realization. And at the other end, at the extreme end of expansion, is an opening of the self to be identical with everything, with the all. That's why Carl Jung called the end of the process the capital S self. He said there's a self, but it's only one self. So the process of this whole process of healing, psychological healing, and then personal growth, and then spiritual realization is a process of simply allowing a larger and larger sense of being to emerge. And you do that, you can't do that by forcing it, that works in the opposite direction. You just do it by allowing it, by inviting it, by creating space. Spaciousness is the metaphor you hear so much. So that's what I suggest you do. So if you don't do anything else in the time that you sit, you just release the usual defensiveness and constrictiveness so that you become a little bit more at home in your body and the world, and a little bit more allowing of everything to be as it is, and a little bit more inclusive of whatever's happening. So instead of the jackhammer being something you fight against, which makes it worse, like chronic pain, it makes it worse, instead you go, oh, jackhammer, how lovely. Or, you can't do that, you at least do what Jack Kornfield said, which is you bow to everything. You just bow to everything, and you just allow everything to be as it is. Okay, let's sit for 10 minutes, okay?
If somebody borrows a book, is there some place you're supposed to write that down?
Or
if somebody borrows a book, are they supposed to write
that
down?
No. It's totally trust. All right, so let's sit for 10 minutes.
introduction is very aggressive. Also, people will... No.
Spencer is telling us that he's going to be obnoxious and read the stuff that I wrote on my website here. It's part of an introduction, so I'm just was warning.
Okay. In case, anyway. So this is Mark Dunlap, D-U-N-L-A-P, and he is the co-director of the Relationship Institute in Santa Barbara. And I'm going to, and the phone number, if you would like it, is 805-683-8183. And his email, can I do that? Can
you
do
that? Yeah, and let me see, can you actually hear me when I am speaking like this?
No. Oh, yeah.
So let me just, you know, one of the things,
gotta hit like this. Okay, well, one of the things that came floating into my mind as we were starting, as you were leading us through that space there, that I used to do things like this as kind of a PR activity, and that's actually not why I'm here today. I'm very full in my practice. I don't need new clients, but I'm always happy for people to reach out to me. But Spencer, just having said if he's going to give out our phone number, my answering machine for at least 6 months has said, we're not taking new clients. Please don't leave a message. So I would hate for you to bang into that. But if you do want to reach out to me, just Google on me and find this website that he's talking about, the Relationship Institute of Santa Barbara, and send me an email, and I will respond to that. So I just wanted to give you a channel that actually will get to me.
Okay. I'm going to keep doing this. Well, I'm less than you because I just got boosted again, but I am with students. But I think we'll be all right too. All right, so a rather detailed introduction, but I think one that some of you will recognize various of these people that he talks about. This is, I'm quoting him from the Relationship of Santa Barbara website. Over the years, I have trained in and been influenced by a variety of therapeutic modalities. These include especially approaches that integrate the mind and the body, such as Gestalt therapy, Radix Neo-Reichian, and somatic experiencing, and various approaches that have a strong influence, emphasis on mindfulness. I am also influenced by John Bradshaw's inner child work, and by internal family systems therapy, by the idea that we all have many parts of ourselves which we need to get working in harmony with each other. I have been very interested in men's issues and led men's groups for a number of years. I have led workshops at Eslam Institute and have taught classes on relationships for SBCC's Center for Extended Learning, formerly Adult Ed, for over 20 years. Mark fell in love with Dora and they married in 1983. About 1990, quoting him again, about 1990, I began to think there must be a better marriage than the one we're having. Dora and I had been married about 7 years, and though most people would say we had a pretty good marriage, we were arguing more than we wanted, feeling disconnected often, and just not feeling like we were having a relationship we could really be having. We were both trained as therapists, yet I didn't feel like I really understood what was going on in marriage or how to do it well. We chanced upon Harbaugh Hendricks' book, Getting the Love You Want. It made so much sense that we went to a workshop with him and then began training in his method, Imago Therapy. We found it so helpful that we decided to start more of our time helping couples transform their relationships into ones that are truly satisfying. Imago Therapy's ideas and practices have remained the core of how I think about and work with couples.
How do you spell them?
I-M-A-G-O, Imago. So Imago Therapy's ideas and practices have remained the core of how I think about and work with couples, but over the years I continued to study and learn from many other interesting and valuable approaches that come along. Among these are attachment-based approaches like Sue Johnson's Emotionally Focused Couples Therapy and Stan Tatkin's Psycho-Neurobiological Approach to Couples Therapy. That's a helpful but interesting work. Other important influences are John Gottman's scientifically-based marriage therapy, the work of Ellen Bader and Terry Real, and the work of Pat Love and Esther Perel in the area of sexuality. In essence, what I try to bring to my work with both individuals and couples is the best of current approaches tailored to the individual needs of my clients. So I'm very pleased and honored to introduce Mark Dunlap. And I think what I'd like to do is question him somewhat myself, and then have you open it for you to question him. But as you talk, if they have questions that come from what you're saying, do you want to take them directly or do you want to have them wait? In other words, they can raise their hand when something that you said sparks something that they want to.
I like to do it directly.
Okay, so if you have a question, you don't have to hold it. When he says something that sparks you, just raise your hand and you'll deal with it then. Yeah? Okay, so it will be interactive. All right, so these are...
Unless I happen to be on a roll.
If I happen to be on a roll and I'm making a point, I might want to pause and finish whatever it is I'm putting together, but then I would like to get to the question. Yeah.
Apology in advance for these questions. Some of these are impossible questions, and you're going to take them in whatever way you can take them. Because if I was asked these questions, I would look at the question like, what? But this is what came to me in the middle of the night, last couple of nights, what can I tell you? All right, so why do individuals, we're going to talk about individuals first and couples, okay? So why do individuals come for therapy or guidance? What are the most common reasons why they come into your office?
Let me say a little bit about the format here. Okay, we gotta do it sort of like, there we go, like this.
Like not down, like more.
All right, okay. Spencer invited me to come and talk to his class here, and I thought, well, that'll be fun. I really don't know what we were gonna be talking about. The other day we spoke and he said, you want me to give you a list of questions? And I said, you know, let's just see what happens. Right, let's just, so it'll be fresher. So you can just run some questions by me and we'll see where we go here. Which of course makes it impossible to prepare. But I'm not giving that question yet. Part of the question, people go with it, I just wasn't expecting that question. A lot of what brings people in is, well, let me answer it this way, that I was trained in individual therapy for many years and really thought it was all about what goes on inside of people. And so, yeah, things happen with mom, they happen with dad, whatever it is, but then we organize ourselves inside about that and we decide to feel certain ways or don't allow ourselves to be certain ways or have certain emotional injuries that we need to work out. And the point of therapy is to come in and work on that stuff. And so generally that is why people show up. They say, there's something going amiss in my life and I want to work on it. I think that is what brings people in. Right before we are meeting here, you know, I hear this impressive resume, and I go, like, oh, who's this guy? I'd like to talk to this guy. When I head out the door, my wife Dora says, well, have fun. You know, you're going out to do this thing. And a part of me says, yeah, I want to do this because I want to have fun. Then there is another part of me, which the term these days, I guess, the current term is imposter syndrome, where we feel like we're really just kind of flying it by the seat of our pants. We don't really know what we're doing, but we actually seem to be successful at it. But there's a part of us that is going, man, what do you say if I'm going to get found out here? You know? And there is a part of me that has that, that gets going. And I happen to decide to walk over here, because what I parked six blocks away. And this is just a life skill I learned may or may not be useful to you, and you may already know this, but when I used to work as a musician performing, and I would be having stage fright, and it's like there's energy in the body that you can't do anything with because you're not performing yet, so you're just feeling sort of pent up. I would go out and walk for a while before, just go the time walking for 10 minutes and then come in and perform to kind of dissipate some of that energy. But also, I just find it psychologically very empowering to know that we can actually move around, that we're not trapped somewhere, but we can actually, you know, get here and there and escape from the situation if we need to. So I find walking is a good thing to do before any kind of performance. So I decided to walk for a few blocks here, and I walked by this apartment that I used to live in, I'm going to say almost 50 years ago, when I was in my 20s, and I was learning to be a therapist. I never would have imagined that I would have become a relationship therapist. That was like, I didn't even know that was a thing. And so it's just been interesting that that's happened over the years. And some of why it happened was, you kind of alluded to it there, that I got married and I thought, my goodness, what is this about? Why is it so difficult to be in a long-term relationship? And so I decided to start working on it and try to figure it out. So I've spent over 30 years, pushing 40 now, trying to figure it out and have made some progress. And I'm happy to talk about whatever the next question is.
So I have a question to follow that question, which is, You began by saying that we thought it was about what went on inside us that we had to kind of come to terms with when you first were learning therapy. I know in relationship it can't just be about what's inside you, it has to be about what goes, but more generally, has your view of therapy widened to the extent that it's more about how you relate to the other people in the world and less about the internal dynamics, or in addition to the internal dynamics?
It's kind of in addition that, yeah, who I am, how I function in the world forms up when I'm growing up. But when I enter into the world of relationship, all these things come into play. And in our relationships, and you mentioned a guy named Carlo Hendricks, who is my favorite teacher in the world of relationship. And he wrote a book that I'm going to recommend called Getting the Love You Want, which has been like 40 years now that book has been out. A lot of good stuff has come along since then, but he had, I think, some insights that nobody had had before, or he put some things together. And he came up with an idea that in a relationship, there's kind of two things that can happen. There's emotional healing that can happen, and there's growth. So there's healing and growth, and those are actually different things. And in order to succeed in a relationship, we are probably going to have to do some growing. The relationship will call us to become more self-aware and more attentive to another partner and learn how to do things differently. And if we can do that, then some emotional healing can happen for one or both of us, because old emotional wounds can actually be healed in relationship. So if we get with a partner who will actually work with us, and we can work with them. We can put some healing ointment on some of those things that happened earlier in life. But in order for that to happen, there usually is some growth that needs to happen, because we will pick a partner that is almost inevitably difficult to be with. And that seems to be the way it is. And I remember when I was doing my studies and getting my license in marriage and family therapy. This was when I was in my early 30s and newly married. And I was not interested in couples work at all. I was very interested in individual work and working with men. And I thought, couples therapy, whatever it is just too difficult. Why would anybody want to do that? It's too hard. So I didn't really recognize the possibility in it until I came across Earl Hendricks' work. And it's like, oh, I get it, how we can actually do this. Like I'm rambling a little bit here, but...
So I want to ask you about two things that you just said. So you said, inevitably, in the relationship, the old wounds are going to be opened. And then the question is, what do you do once these old wounds are... They came from childhood, so they're relationship wounds, and now they're opened again in relationship. And so, what do you do next? Otherwise, well, that's just a bleeding wound. And secondly, so that's the first part of it. And yeah, the second part of it was... you're saying that we inevitably pick people that open those wounds. So.
Now, this is a theory. You know, I happen to subscribe to it. Just about everybody who ever shows up into my office that fits this theory. We will. The way that I learned about it in grad school was, we tend to pick people who remind us of mom and or dad, and will tend to re-injure us in kind of the same sort of a way. And that's too bad. Sort of end of the story. And what Harville Hendricks did was he said, well, actually, yes, we seem to be actually designed to do that. We seek out the familiar. And it's a form of trying to get it right. And if we can actually get it right, it's amazing stuff can happen. We can have emotional healing, but we have to be able to grow in order to do it. So, there's a lot of people who write about relationships. If you read Harville Hendricks or hang out with him much, he is something of a visionary. He has these big ideas. That attracts me. I am both a very scientific person at times, but also very interested in kind of big ideas. And one of his big ideas is that the human species has managed to become flawed in such a way, and we're still trying to develop ourselves, and we manage to emotionally wound our children, and then they grow up and don't behave all that well. And so nature has actually generated this idea of a committed relationship based on romantic attraction that is a place where we can heal and get ourselves together, basically. And then we will parent our children better, and we will relate to other people better if we can navigate the crucible of the committed relationship.
Think what they told us. Oh God. So the next question I have here is a question I wasn't even going to ask you, but because it's an unfair question, but they're the sequence of them, unfortunately. Yeah, you can say next. Okay. All right, so the next question is, what would you like everybody to know? What would you like everybody to know?
Oh,
I guess from my own experience, I would want everyone to know that relationships aren't actually possible. It tends to take a lot of work. Now, there may be people out there that I don't happen to encounter who just sail through life very happily, and so they would never show up in my office, or they would never show up in a class. Maybe those people are out there, but for most of us, it does take work and commitment, and we also need to learn some skills that a lot of us don't have the relationship skills we need, and they're not that difficult. But a lot of us growing up in our family situation, we didn't quite get the right toolkit for a relationship. And so there's stuff that we can, and they're learnable things, and then we can be more successful. And something else, I feel like there's a giving up too quickly thing that is going on in our culture. You know, I came of age in the 1960s and 70s, and divorce became a thing. It was finally okay to divorce, which of course I think it is okay for people to divorce, of course, but it sort of became, oh great, if this relationship is not working, I'll just throw it away and we'll do something else. And then we'll go out and pick a very similar sort of partner and do the same thing again. And then go along for a while and then throw that away because it's getting a little bit too difficult. So I think one thing that is missing some is kind of a tenacity that people can hang in a little more often in relationships. And then I also want to temper that with the idea that, of course, if a relationship is really terrible and you need to get out of it, of course you can get out of it, you know. But that's one thing, is to kind of hang in and hold the course.
And the other thing you alluded to is certain skills. So if you had to pick one skill, that's another question, but if there was one skill that people tend not to, that is a real necessary skill that people tend not to have,
make it three.
Well developed.
Make it three.
Well, I don't want
yeah, I'm just asking about one.
Three is easy.
Yeah, I was thinking at least two.
Yeah.
What is the capacity? I'm like this, can you hear me? Do I have to get in here closer? Okay, I'm doing all right. What is the capacity to listen and actually be, and similar to what Spencer, I believe, is teaching you and you're all working with in this class, of actually being present. And if I can actually be present, and then I can actually listen to you, and I believe, and I'm not a huge formal student of philosophy, but I believe it was Martin Buber, the philosopher, who came up with this idea of the I-thou relationship, which is treating another person as a person rather than an object. And the idea of the I-thou relationship is, if I happen to be listening to you, then let me say it this way. We're all sitting here in our own worlds. I've got what's going on inside of me. Spencer's got what's going on inside of him. You've all got what's going on inside of you. And we're kind of interfacing here. When I'm listening to you, if I can be present and making your reality, what is going on with you, equally or even more important than what is going on with me. So I am really trying to understand what is going on with you. Now, as I'm listening to you, I may have all sorts of thoughts and reactions, and I don't like what you're saying, and how could you be thinking that about me, and this doesn't feel good. That's all going on, but if I can, for a period of time, put that aside and just attend to what it is that's actually going on with you, I think that's a central relationship skill. You know, and that will lead to empathy, right? First, it's like really, do we have, we're in a demographic here where maybe this question actually makes sense. Do we have fans of the original Star Trek here? Yeah, about a third of you maybe. Well, there was this thing that Spock used to do. It was called the Vulcan mind meld. he could approach an alien creature or even something like a rock or something, and he would put his hand on it, and he would be able to kind of empathically understand what was going on with that person. And so that's the kind of attitude that I think is useful. Is like, you know, your world is different than mine, but if I can really understand what it is. And then another useful skill is to, and this leads into an idea that is something called differentiation, which is sort of a technical term, but it has to do with allowing you and me to be different. We are actually different people. And we can think different thoughts, and we can have different ideas, and heaven forfend, we can even have different political persuasions, and we can feel differently, and that's okay. And I don't have to make you wrong for being different than I am. I can just try to understand what the differences are. And that leads to an idea that is sometimes called validation, which is basically, I'm letting you know that what's going on in your world, what you're thinking, what you're feeling, how you're seeing things, actually does make sense to me. That you are actually a sensible person as opposed to a crazy person. You actually do make sense, even though what's going on with you, it is not what's going on with me. You know, so we want to not fall into the trap, which is called being symbiotic, which means we're kind of really emotionally fused, and that we have to be the same. And often when people are first in a relationship, they're like this. They're just like ecstatic about, you know, oh, we went to see that movie, and you like that movie too. Yeah, we both like the same movie, and you like broccoli too? And we're all excited about all these things of how we are the same. So there's this kind of a delusion that gets going, that you and I are the same. The way Horval Hendricks says it is, you and I are the same, and I'm the one. So you and I are one, and I'm the one. So it's just all about me, basically. And it can be very disturbing when it starts showing up, well, wait a minute, you don't like, you know, I married somebody from South America, from Peru. And this shows you a little bit about my cultural stereotypes I had, because we were first dating and we were going to go out to dinner, and I said, oh yeah, let's go over here and have some Mexican food. And she says, I don't like Mexican food. And I said, wait a minute, you're from Latin America, you should like Mexican food. No, she doesn't. Mexican food and Peruvian food are very, very different. And if you haven't ever had Peruvian food, find some. It's really, really good. So learning to tolerate the differences, that I can let you be you and I can be me, and we can be interested in that rather than trying to change the other person into another version of me. You know, we sort of have, I think, this delusion that wouldn't life be great if we went out and found somebody just like us. And my best guess is we would drive each other crazy or bore each other to death if we found it somebody just like us. So we need to learn to celebrate the differences.
That turned out to be a pretty good question. All right, so since we hit it out of the park, you hit it out of the park.
Because this is like such a
wide open question. So learning to listen well is really important. Something that is an ongoing challenge is, and I don't know, have you talked in here about the old brain and reactive brain and that stuff? Do you guys talk much about that?
We haven't. Do it. We haven't.
I'll just do it really simply. In our evolution, or if you don't believe in evolution, in our creation, whatever, you know, we just happen to share some systems that particularly with reptiles and mammals, kind of the way our brain developed. And if we think about our reptilian brain, which is just a about keeping us alive, basically. And our mammalian brain, we share with the other mammals, and I think of dogs as a great example of this. It's all about, I mean, besides surviving, it's about assessing the relationship and sort of this fundamental question, are you friendly or not? The old, are we going to play and have fun together, or are you going to be against me and we're going to have a hard time here? The primitive, the reptilian brain is just trying to stay safe, and it feels threatened very easily. And the mammalian brain is trying to assess the relationship, and is it safe or friendly here? So there is this, what we could call the big brain question, that's running all the time. Is it safe here, and are you friendly? And when it doesn't feel safe, and that can be emotionally safe, you're not going to come after me with a baseball bat or something. It's just that, you know, I'm going through some emotional pain with you, so it doesn't feel very safe. If it's not feeling safe, and it's not feeling very friendly, we have a very small number of old brain reactions that come into play, often very powerfully. And I'm going to say what those are in a minute. But we have to learn to somewhat know those things in ourselves and overcome them. We have to be able to get beyond our what we would call our reactivity. And the old brain reactive stuff is, people think of fight or flight. Okay, it's fight or flight stuff. If you're a threat to me, I'm going to try to run away from you. Okay, I'm going to get away from this source of pain. Or if you're causing me some sort of pain, I'm going to come after you and try to control you and make you change that and knock that off so I'm not in some kind of pain. So we get flight, we get fight, we get a kind of a shutdown thing, which is my favorite one that I learned how to do, where we just kind of shut down and get very quiet and remote and removed from the situation. And interestingly, this seems to be, it's mediated by something called the dorsal vagal nerve. It's part of the parasympathetic system, if you like neurological trivia. But the point is, it's something that we share with sharks. And I call it sleeping shark mode. Because sharks actually cannot lie down on the ocean floor to sleep because they would die. They actually have to have water moving through their gills at all times to get a little bit of oxygen out of it. So if a shark were to lie down on the ocean floor, it would die. So the way that it sleeps is it just slows everything way down. And the movements slow way down, and the heartbeat slows way down. And if whatever shark consciousness is like, it's probably kind of like a rheostat that just gets dimmed way down. So it's just kind of cruising along in kind of a comatose state. And those of us who use shutdown as our way of dealing with distress around us kind of get like that. We get very quiet and withdrawn and slow. So we've got like fight, flight, shutting down. There's another one that's placating. It's like what dogs do if the bigger dog is getting the best of it. They kind of, you know, give in, cry uncle, so to speak. And so we'll often be in a discussion with somebody. We'll just, oh, never mind, fine, whatever you want, we give in. That doesn't work real well either. So these are these old brain relationship strategies that most of us have a propensity to. One of these is our favorite, and it's interesting to think about, you know, for yourself, what is that? We might have a favorite and then kind of a backup. When that one doesn't work, we do something else. But they do not work well in relationship. They work quite well in nature. They get us through childhood. If we happen to have had kind of a difficult childhood, it's what the best thing we can figure out how to do. But in our adult relationships, they don't work. So we have to learn to be aware of that stuff and do something else. Intention. So kind of use the top part of our brain to intentionally say, well, what are some actually better things that I can do? And, you know, one of them I just mentioned was listening well, you know. How many of you have taken any of the compassionate communication, nonviolent communication classes here? Yeah. That's a really good model for sending messages, like how to organize, you know, this is what's happening, this is what I'm feeling, this is what I'm thinking about it, this is what I'm wanting, and this is what I would like you to do. Learning that skill is really a good one. So that's kind of in sending. If you think about communication, there's kind of like two roles in any given moment. There's sending, like right now I am talking, so I am saying something. So I'm trying to communicate, send a message. And hopefully you're listening, so you would be in receiving mode. So there's sending and receiving. Although there's a lot of little micro stuff happens. So as I'm sending here, I'm also kind of looking, and oh, I see that person's face is kind of telling me that they're with me. So we're kind of reading a bunch of stuff. But if you simplify it down to sending and receiving. So the nonviolent communication model, I think, is especially good for learning how to send your message well. And then I'm also talking about, you know, the importance of learning how to listen to receive well. I may be like one of these people in the political debate or whatever it is, where we're not having a debate, fortunately. But you ask a question and then I'll just go where I'm going to go with it.
It's exactly what I was hoping would happen. And again, if you have questions that come up, just raise your hand and we'll acknowledge them. So I do see a question. Abraham, can you yell it and then I'll repeat it?
Yeah, you mentioned a relationship between you and another, you know, I and thou.
Right.
But what about the relationship that you could have between you and yourself?
Okay. So the question is, what about a relationship between you and yourself?
To me, a lot of the same principles. In the sense of, I mean, I haven't said it this way yet, but in terms of the relationship to ourselves, and I do believe that we have a lot of different parts of ourself. Now, as Spencer was saying earlier, and I do also agree, there is sort of a capital S self deep in us somewhere. But we also have all these different parts of ourselves that show up. And in fact, there's a system that's become popular recently. It's the latest iteration of this thing. It's called internal family systems. But the idea that we all have lots of different parts has been around for a long time. And I think what's important is to become aware of the different parts of ourselves and bring them in rather than banish them. Oftentimes people have, you know, there's something about me that I don't like very much, so I'm just going to try to get rid of it or pretend it's not around, or, you know. It's much more useful to acknowledge the parts of ourselves that we don't particularly like and bring them in and give them some love and compassion and find out what are they actually trying to do in the world, so that we can be more embracing to the different parts of ourselves. I don't know if that's exactly answering what you're asking about, but...
Well, you know, most of the time when you do some work with yourself and understand your feelings and your emotion, that would work better when you relate to somebody else. Because you know where you stand and you know how to approach the other person. So, in my experience, you know, I failed in my relationship when I was given more than keeping things for myself and giving more to the other person than keeping things for myself. In other words, I disrespect myself to please the other person. And it did not work. So when I got out of the relationship, I start realizing, you know, that I need to listen to me more. And then the following relationship was a beautiful relationship when I started listening to me. So sometimes we have to balance between the two. You know, relationship with yourself and also relationship with another. And it worked better in my life, so that's why I brought up the question.
Yeah, I'm hoping you could hear what he was saying there. That in a previous relationship, it was so much giving and focus on the other person that you weren't respecting yourself. And when in a new relationship, you're balancing that much better. Yeah, there is. One way to think about this is that there's a spectrum that somebody can be at one end of the spectrum or the other end of this spectrum, and we're not talking about autism here, we're just talking about a spectrum, or you can be somewhere in the middle. And the one end of this is being totally self-absorbed. I'm just thinking about me, what do I want, what can I get out of this situation, what can you do for me? And I look back with some regret and realize I used to be a lot on that end in my relationships. So you get people who are totally self-absorbed, basically narcissistic, and they're just all about themselves. And then at the other end of the spectrum, it can be, it's all about the other person. And that's what people will call codependency. It's like, I'm so, in a way, insecure or afraid in the relationship, or for whatever reason, or I've been trained to be an overly giving person, whatever it is, that I'm trying to meet your needs, and trying to meet your needs, and trying to keep you happy, and I'm losing myself in the process, or I'm kind of throwing myself under the bus. So we want to find some kind of a middle ground where I can be in touch with what it is that I'm wanting and needing from you, and I can be attentive to what you're looking for from me, and we can work together on that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Spencer?
Another hand.
I have a question when it comes to relationships with your mature children. Okay. I have two daughters, one, I have a very good one, and the other daughter is more judgmental, like you're saying, and it's really hard to get through. I shut down. And how does one handle that as a mature parent, supposedly?
So reiterate what your question is.
Okay, so
this is where I'm tended to claim above my pay grade on this one. I'm really good with couples, not so much with families. So the question was, getting along with our adult children, and you mentioned a little bit of the dynamic there. That is a tough one. You know, I don't have as facile answers to that as I do. You know, there's a transition, obviously, that needs to happen from a child who is dependent on the parent, and the parent is guiding the child, to a point where, you know, they're grown up now, and they're an adult, they're an equal adult with you. And I'm not quite sure what exactly the challenges are. Do you want to say more about?
No, I was just saying a relationship of getting along and having communication-wise, and understanding that person from where you're coming from, but not, I guess you would say
non-wise. I don't want to do that. I don't want to do that. That would be precarious cohort-wise. I would rather...
okay, so...
I would rather a PG.
Right, okay.
My somewhat simplistic answer is really try to understand what's going on with that person. You know, in this case, it's your daughter. Even though biologically our children are adults, sometimes when they get in relationship with us, they may not act like it. And I think, you know, we try to have to try to hold the adult position, whatever that would look like. You know, and it can be hard sometimes. Yeah.
I realize with this type of relationship that I have, the inner child and that person. So when that happens, it flashes, oh, it's the inner child and that person, don't get upset and just let it go. I mean, that's how I'm handling it now to a certain point, not take it so personally.
Yeah, trying not to take it so personally, that sounds wise, yeah.
The question was about, the comment that Barbara made was, she realizes that it's the inner child in the person that is expressing herself or himself, and so she doesn't take it personally. And I would just add to that, whenever you have an issue with somebody, if you can temporarily let go of yourself and try to understand why the other person is saying what they're saying or doing what they're doing, and then let them know that you understand why they're saying what they're saying, they're doing what they're doing. Then you can say, maybe that isn't the best strategy, but I certainly understand where you're coming from and that's valid, that where you're coming from, it's just I'm suggesting that isn't the best way to get what you need. But when you first affirm the person, then it's a lot easier to correct the behavior. Okay, so let's see. Why do people...
There's something I want to mention here. And this doesn't have to be in our intimate partnership or our committed relationship, maybe with anybody. The importance of Stephen Covey, the Seven Habits of Highly Effective People guide, one of his principles was seek first to understand and then to be understood. So how that translates into is if you're upset with me, if I can really make an effort to understand what that is about, rather than trying to tell you what's going on with me, it's like first we have to do that successfully. And I see this a lot in relationships, that people will get defensive in the sense of they want to explain what is happening. You are upset with me, and I want to explain why it is that I did what I did. Now, John Gottman and a whole bunch of other people will say that that is a form of defensiveness, that explaining is a form of defensiveness. And it sort of is, but I also think it's really important because I know I hate to be misunderstood. And probably most of us will remember the Eric Burden and the Animals song, "Oh Lord, I'm just a soul whose intentions are good. Please don't let me be misunderstood." We all know that song, right? And it sticks in our mind because it feels terrible to be misunderstood. So if something has happened between the two of us and you're mad with me or upset with me, my knee-jerk response, particularly if I feel like you don't get why I did this, that is actually even not what happened, and you're upset, I will want to immediately jump in and try to explain, yeah, but really, that's not what happened, or I didn't mean to do that, or whatever it is. That is not satisfying to the person who has been wounded. It's almost like they have the talking stick and they have the floor and they're upset about something. And as soon as I jump in and say, well, actually, it's like I'm grabbing the talking stick away from them. And so what has to happen is if I can listen to you well enough and get that you're upset about this or hurt about it or scared about it or whatever, and that you get the feeling that I actually do understand that, then I may be able to explain what happened from my perspective. But first, I have to be able to feel your distress. Right? So this may somehow be applicable with your daughter now. Okay.
All right, so next question. These questions, boy. Why do people do what, why don't people do what they know they should do? So Spencer, why don't they? It's so interesting, I was not expecting these sorts of questions. Wow. Oh, yeah, I wish you get to hold it this way. That's certainly true that people, including me, do not always do what we need to do. I tend to think some of it is habitual. Sometimes we have just developed habits that our brain just wants to do the thing and run the behavior. But oftentimes also it is that there is some part of us that does, that wants to do something different than what we, that whoever we is, like I've decided to do something and then some other part of me is going down a different track. It's because that is some part of me that is unsatisfied in some way and needs something. And if I can actually spend some time attending to that part of me, understand, again, it's trying to apply understanding to, yeah, what is going on with me that I'm not doing the thing that I say that I'm going to do, rather than just shaming myself or getting mad at myself about it, but actually try to understand what it is, and then maybe I can get everybody internally aligned in the same direction, you know, hopefully.
I don't want to leave this. I'm not understanding. I'm ultimately partially understanding. So what you said is that there's different parts of me, and one part of me, by habit, wants to continue the same thing. Another part of me wants something different. But typically what happens is people, that part that wants something different isn't very visible. People, you know, they know, speaking for myself, but other people too, that you know what steps that you need to take to make things better, but you don't take them. People sometimes never take them, or it takes a lot of encouragement for them to take them. Why is it that there must be some active resistance or some reason why people bear those ills they have rather than run to others they know not of? I think that's the answer, actually. See, is it because, all right, so I guess, is it because we know the misery we're in, and if we were to do something different, it's scary because it might be worse?
I think that's one of the possible reasons, absolutely. You know, what I do not believe in is that people have an inherent desire to self-sabotage. I just don't buy that. I never have. But yeah, it may be that the thing that some part of me is deciding to do is too scary for some other part of me. Or it's easier to keep doing the familiar thing. And certainly if we done things in the past that have turned out badly and painfully, we still may want whatever that result is, but the idea of confronting that distress again is more than we want to do, so we shy away from it. That certainly goes on too, I think.
By the way, I have no idea why the sky is falling. Is everybody hearing that besides me? I mean, is there somebody on the roof, or is that part of the sound system?
Probably acorns falling on the oak trees.
Anyway, things haven't fallen through the roof yet. Okay, yell loud. Tell me your first name.
Barbara.
Okay, yell loud.
So, you can choose to answer this or not. It's kind of philosophical. You spend your life dealing with relationships. My question is about monogamy, and whether you think that's a social construct that has seen its day, that it's a necessity for human beings, or what, based on, like, new anthropological research is saying maybe people lived in communities and had more than one partner and that sort of thing. So I'm kind of wondering, what's your thought on that being a relationship expert?
Okay, so the question is monogamy, what about monogamy? Is monogamy old school? Is there some other more recent understanding? So I'm just repeating this because some people need to hear.
That is a great question, which I think about. I don't have a definitive answer to that. You know, having come of age in the 60s and 70s, you know, and pre-love, and then it was open marriage, and then it kind of went quiet for a while, and now it's back as polyamory. It keeps coming around, right? The idea keeps coming around. I have known a few people that succeeded at multiple relationships. Well, first of all, I don't have any ethical position on it. It's like, if it works, it works. I'm just interested in, does it actually work? I've seen a lot of people kind of suffer going down that track. And is that because some part of us is possessive and jealous and we're not willing to share and we can't, you know, we just can't tolerate a partner having intimacy with somebody else. And it's just, the question is that built into our nature or is that something we can learn how to transcend? And it's an open question. I don't really know. I haven't seen people have a whole lot of success with it, but it doesn't mean they're not. Yeah, and I know it is, you know, it's something that was put in place for various reasons, social reasons, that you have to have one person, one partner, you know. I happen to believe that there's some part of me, I'm a guy, it would be interesting to have sexual relationships with a lot of different people, but I think a wiser part of me really holds to the idea that if we can have that particular type of relationship be special with one person, it's really a good idea, because we can have many different kind of friendships and relationships, but if we contain our sexuality to with one person, that makes the relationship stand apart from anything else, other relationships. But if people want to try it and it works for them, you know, great.
Yeah. Don't you think, though, that this goes way back to the DNA? Like, if you take dogs and cats, they have multiple relationships because in the DNA is, I want to spread my seed all over the place and have a lot more of the other planet.
Yeah.
So it moves, and then with our society, we say, well, that is the right, we shouldn't do this. And it's been a conflict back and forth. I think that it doesn't work, obviously. They have multiple children.
Right.
So I don't know if you heard the comment.
You should repeat.
Yeah, I want to. Was that? Well, isn't this? This is just like a commentary I have. That there's a field of psychology, it used to be called sociobiology, and I think it got so discredited they had to rename it evolutionary psychology. But it's basically trying to understand how things actually are. How do we operate as human beings and animals, basically? And then come up with explanations for why that would make sense that we do this, sort of based on survival. You know, survival. And that, what you're saying, is, I think, in that category. Now, it doesn't mean that a lot of these stories that get spun around behaviors are not accurate. I think it's just interesting to recognize that there are kind of stories that we make up. So I do think it is true. I don't know if it's as true for women as it is for men. I honestly don't know. But that men will have a propensity to want to scatter their seed here and there. That does seem to be built into our biological nature. So I think that is there. So if we decide not to do that, it's a sort of a more of a commitment from our heads, basically, that we're going to choose a different path. There's a woman named, I want to say Helen, but it's not, somebody, Helen Fisher, who is an anthropologist who studied people all over the world, and she studied relationships and committed relationships, and she said, you know, we think that we invented divorce in the United States in the 1960s, but that is actually not the case. That throughout history, people will tend to change up partners at about 7 years. We think it's the 4-year itch, but it's really the 7-year itch. And she says that may be based on the idea that it's, you know, we've got together with somebody and we've kind of raised a family and the kids are kind of at this age and now it's time for me to move on and spread the genetic material elsewhere and start a new family. For whatever reason, maybe want to change it up. I think that may very well be true. And my solution to that is for those of us who actually want to stay with one partner for the long run, that we have to keep it interesting and change it up with our current partner. So, and that doesn't mean exotic sexual positions or, you know, putting plastic bags over your head or anything. It's just...
Those are the long old.
It's just finding ways to keep the relationship with the same partner interesting. And so that we can not wander off with somebody else.
I think you're right. I think the solution that really is to, like, I was fortunate enough to find a wife 61 years ago who I love and is totally taken by us and why I had not wanted to go. That's the secret.
Yeah. So maybe we should have you come up here and tell us about it.
I want to comment a tiny bit on that and then I'll call on you. There's a difference between dogs and humans evolutionarily. Dogs don't have to nurture their young for a long time before the young are able to succeed. Human beings do, so evolution has given us an attachment, oxytocin, vasopressin attachment system, so that we hang around long enough so that those infants become viable, alive creatures. So, you would expect animals that have to take care of their kids longer before their kids are okay to be animals that are more monogamistic. Stay with the same partner. Is it, what's the word?
Monogamous.
Monogamous. You can't go monogamous. Okay, so you wanted to ask.
Yeah, up to the 17th century in Ireland, there was a legal system called Breton law. They had 9 different marriage contracts to choose from. One of them was marriage for a year, renewable every year by both partners. And women were also economically independent at that time. They could also be judges, lawyers, doctors, whatever. People who talk about history and that miss out on certain areas. It lasted 1,200 years, the legal system.
Okay, so did you hear that? Just to repeat, there were, up until the 1700s in Ireland, there were 9 different marriage contracts, is that what you said? And one of them was a yearly renewal contract.
By both partners.
Mm-hmm. And women were economically viable. They could hold various positions. And so they had equal power in the relationship.
They kept their own money in marriage.
Say again?
They kept their own money in marriage.
Okay. People
their
kept...
own land, it was always their land. And who took care of the kids? That was a whole other thing.
Right. So anyway, what she's saying is that the system we have now isn't the only historical system. But let's move on, shall we?
That's really interesting. I've never heard of that. The only thing I've heard about that at all was not too many years ago in Mexico. The government proposed a sort of a 1-year trial marriage. And then if it worked out, you could sign up. The Catholic Church was not happy.
That's what happened in the 17th century, too. The Catholic Church changed it.
What I like about that is, I think it's unfortunate when couples cling to each other out of desperation, that it's like, oh, I can't live without you, or I, you know, I'm not going to be okay if I don't have a partner. And I think it is much better when people can, and now, this is coming from, in a way, my own character structure. I lived pretty well on my own for a while. I can be sort of a loner, isolated sort of a guy. So I'm sort of speaking from, oh, it's kind of easy to do that. But I think it is good to be able to get along well enough by yourself. So then when you're with your partner, you're choosing to be with them, not just out of some kind of desperation or we sign a lifetime contract. Even though I think the lifetime commitment, I think, is kind of a good idea, but you don't have to be locked into it. It's like when Dora and I married, when Dora and I married, we did not have that in our vows. We were not saying we're signing up for this forever. But as time went along, it's just very clear we are doing that, and nobody's going anywhere. And it's very reassuring to have that. I think kind of like what maybe you guys talk about. You just sort of know we're with each other, and it's good. But that idea that, yeah, I'm not bound to be here, and I kind of need to keep re-choosing the marriage. That's what I like about that contract idea that it puts out in the front. Yeah, it's cool.
So I wanted to mention that if I was talking to my students, they would all look at me like, what? We already have that trial marriage. It's called living together. We all do it. It isn't until we decide way later in life than you guys did that maybe we want a kid or kids that we start to think about something that lasts longer. Because kids, the age at which people are having kids is becoming much later. That's an interesting question. Why do people typically end therapy, and how wisely do they do so when they do so? I mean,
hopefully, when people end therapy wisely, they do so because they feel like they've gotten whatever it is they needed out of it. So they have some sense of completion. Now, when I was trained earlier, there could be a whole thing around termination, like, okay, we're going to terminate the therapy, so now we have to address that as a process, and what's it like to say goodbye, and blah, blah, blah. I don't particularly like goodbyes, I guess. But I'm always, if somebody comes in to see me, and we do some work, they're going to know when they're done with whatever it is we're doing. And the door is always open for them to come back again later on. You know, and yes, over my career, I have sometimes felt like people stop too soon, but that's really their choice, and I can discuss that with them. Like, I mean, maybe we're not looking at this yet, or whatever. But if I put it within the realm of couples therapy, I'm seeing people, and we might start every week, and then we might meet every couple of weeks, and then maybe we're meeting once a month or something. There's a kind of a rhythm to it that I let the clients lead. And it generally fits with, yeah, they don't need to be doing this so often with me anymore because they're becoming much more capable of doing it themselves on their own. And then they'll just kind of feel done. And then they may come back. So I kind of trust their pacing.
So I'm going to add one thing to that, which is frequently, when in a therapeutic relationship, I have gotten to something has emerged, typically an addiction that wasn't mentioned earlier in the therapy, and then that comes up, and then I kind of say, you know, we really do need to look at that because we want you to be at your best, and this seems to be see that person. I mean, over and over again, there seems to be some, in, I don't know about people in general, but people that have some sort of addiction that they're dependent on, when you poke that, I don't see them.
Do you want to say anything about that?
We're talking about maybe what's useful and what works. I remember Gary Linker, who's hopefully still around town here, one time he was talking to a bunch of therapists, and now we're talking more about clinically strategizing here. He says, if you have a client and they're getting ready to leave, you just have to honor that. Just have to honor there, and you might say, well, what are we looking forward to working in the future? And maybe tap onto it a little bit. But you just have to let, even if inside you're saying, I think this is a bad call that they're leading right now, you just have to honor that and pulse it down, and hopefully they'll come around again when they're ready. Robert,
it's loud.
Oh, sorry. Earlier you talked about making a long-term relationship work by keeping it new. Can you give any examples how to do that?
So, how to keep a long-term relationship new by changing it somehow.
I'm going to address that directly in a minute, and I'm going to come at it sort of another idea first, is that you know, one of the things we want to have going on in our relationships is a sense of intimacy. And I'm talking about intimacy in, some people use intimacy as a sort of a euphemism for sex. It's like, oh, we were intimate last night. That is part of being intimate. But what I'm talking about is the broader idea of feeling like you really know me and I really know you. And we have this sense of connection. And we get there by engaging with each other. Intimacy doesn't just fall out of the sky. So oftentimes when people say, oh, I don't feel intimate or connected with my partner anymore, it's because they haven't been doing the things that create intimacy. So they need to start doing more together. So some of it is, you know, deep personal sharing and spending time talking with each other and dealing with our issues and talking about our dreams and hopes and all of that stuff. But there's also just finding new activities, new things to do. Oh, you know, let's take a swim dance class. Or people, when they go travel, they often have that sense of, oh, we're experiencing the world in a new way. So, you know, they feel more connected with each other. So I think there's a lot of different ways to kind of brighten things.
We do swing dance and travel. Anything else?
I don't know. We try bungee jumping. That just happens to be on my list of horror fantasies. That's something I just will never go there, I don't think, in this lifetime. But just kind of keep looking at what could be new and interesting for us. You know, and I think I'm editorializing here a little bit, but especially since we had the COVID lockdown, where most of us didn't go anywhere except to Trader Joe's to go shopping or, you know, whatever it was. And so we fell into that habit of every, this is, and I'm speaking about in my household, every night, at the end of the day, we get dinner together, and then we collapse on the sofa and watch Netflix or Prime Video or whatever we happen to do. Because it's the path of least resistance, and it's enjoyable. But it's like sometimes we have to have something more than that. So I think we have to look at, you know, our kind of media overconsumption and cutting back and finding things that are more engaging and, you know, going for a walk or playing board games or learning something new or, you know, whatever it is.
So I want to, Andrew, one last question that we'll have time for, and this is an unfair question to ask you in a short period of time, but we go over a little bit if we need to. But it's an important question, so I think I want to end with it. Would you like to say anything about emotions versus thoughts? in the healing and growth process. Emotions versus thoughts in the healing and growth process. My first impulse is no. But, so emotions and thoughts in the healing and growth process. I think healing takes place more on an emotional level. And that when I'm letting myself have emotions and be with you emotionally, that is more healing. Right? Thinking, you know, which are ideas and mental constructs and all of that, that's sometimes where we really get in difficult places with each other, because we can think about things very differently, and that's where we need to learn to be differentiated. And so if I can tolerate your thinking about this situation, even if it's not my thinking about it, but hopefully we can get together on an emotional level, which is what empathy is. Yeah.
Oh, that's a beautiful answer. So, because it's time to stop for today, we'll have to stop for today. I know that probably we, well, he's here. You can get him now. We could use a lot more. So, could we have a round of applause for Matt? So much, Mark. That was very interesting, off-the-cuff kind of discussion. I'm very happy that you were up for it, and that you were brave enough to come and face this. Okay. We'll see you next week, folks. Have a great